everyone. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And today we'll be talking not so much about lust, but we'll be talking more about love and relationships. My guest again is Veronica Monet. It's been about 6 months since she's been on the program, a couple of times last May of this year. And she is a relationship and sexuality coach. It can be found at her website, theshamefreezone.com. And today, Veronica and I will be talking about guilt and empathy and more, and shame and low self-esteem. Welcome back to the program, Veronica.
Hey, Diana, I'm really glad to be here and glad to be talking to your listeners today.
Yes, me too. And I wanted to add one thing, and I didn't cue you up before, but you're really good at responding to the moment. I think in light of all of the sexual harassment news lately, that I wanted to mention, and this is certainly tied in with, shame and even anger. There was a research study that showed how strong men and pretty women, and these are people that are more likely over the course of evolution, they have more power, especially the strong men, to cause harm or withhold benefits. And it turns out that the strong men and the, they don't have to be pretty women, but in this case it was pretty women, are more apt to be angered more easily than their peers. And I think that the primary benefit of this anger that they experience is preventing oneself from being exploited in the case of the women. Do you have a response to that?
Well, first of all, I have no idea where this research is coming from and who the researchers are, so I can't vouch for the veracity of it at all.
Yes.
I've never heard of such a thing as pretty women are more prone towards anger. Plus, I would like to just interject the idea that the whole idea of who is attractive and who's not attractive is a pretty subjective metric itself.
It is, indeed. You're right.
Yeah. But the sexual harassment flurry that's been overtaking Hollywood has certainly been on my mind. I've been reflecting on it because, you know, some people that I really love, like George Takei and
yes.
Kevin Spacey, you know, these people are winding up with accusations, and most, I don't know what George Takei's response was, but I certainly know Kevin Spacey did not deny it. And it's sad and it's disillusioning and it's like, you know, but it is actually a reflection of my experience of Hollywood. I have a very limited experience with Hollywood, but when I was in my 20s, I went out on a date with a Hollywood producer, and he made it quite clear that I was going to have to be sexual with him if I wanted to be an actress in that town, and I declined. But suffice to say, I got my butt back to San Francisco and gave up on the whole idea of being an actress. Not that I was all that attached to that anyway. I really always wanted to be a writer. But I was only down in Hollywood for 2 weeks, and I experienced a lot of sexual harassment, including on the set when auditioning for a B-movie. So it's there. It's actually, I think if we try to figure out who these bad apples are, these bad men who have abused their power, we're kind of missing the point, which is that it's really endemic to Hollywood culture. And in a lot of ways, it's actually endemic to male culture, and particularly when it comes to powerful males. So the higher up you get into the good old boy network, the more this is actually really just kind of the status quo. So, and it obviously has nothing to do with party affiliation or politics. You can be very liberal, very progressive, and maybe even consider yourself feminist in some way, and yet wind up indulging in this particular, well, it's a form of misogyny. It's a sexism, and it's worse because it's definitely abuse of power. But it's become so normalized in the power structure itself that I think that's where we need to look at it instead of trying to figure out what are the personal failings of these particular men. Because I think we're going to find out pretty much they all did it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's wrong with Hollywood, I think, is a great question. And then what's wrong with our systems of, you know, they're very hierarchical, they're usually dominance-oriented. We don't do a lot of power sharing. We've kind of got top-down in most of our structures. And I personally have experienced not sexual harassment from women, but certainly sexist harassment. I had a female employer. I didn't even work for her. She just happened to work in the department right next to the one where my supervisor and I worked. And she got angry at me because I wouldn't get her a hamburger on my lunch hour. And she didn't just get angry. She put a two-year campaign to get me fired. So,
really?
So, yeah.
That was shades of Meryl Streep's role in which she played the editor of Vogue, and how she demanded so much from her assistant, everything.
I think what happens for people who work their way up the ranks, and
yes.
You know, here's the thing too, we don't realize, I mean, what's coming out now is that there have been plenty of male actors have been sexually harassed or abused or raped, mm-hmm. on their way to the top as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anybody, regardless of their gender, who works their way up to the top of a particular company or profession could find themselves inclined to abuse that power because they probably had to submit to some abuse of power on the way up. And so then it's almost like they may feel entitled, like, this is what I had to do to get here, and by God, you're going to do the same. Or I kind of, you know, I earned my right to be, to have this power because
I think
there's a lot of.
I do think that goes on, and it reflects, in my mind, Sigmund Freud's theory about repetition compulsion, and that we do and do and do again until the story has a happier ending. One kind of fascinating example of this is that a man who was sexually abused at age 8 will sometimes grow up to be a perpetrator, and he searches out an 8-year-old boy, and he wants that boy to have a better experience than he did. I mean, that's another sort of ramification. I don't think that those things go on so much with sexual harassment in Hollywood. I think you're right, it's an abuse of power, and it's become so normalized. I'm not sure that everyone, though, does it. Like, people like Tom Hanks have this. He gets the reputation of being so nice. I just can't imagine him doing it. But
well, I never say never, but
yeah, right, I know.
I can tell you some stories about some clerics and rabbis, so I just feel that when it comes, here's another thing about sexuality, okay?
Mm-hmm.
People can have very, very strong moral code about every facet of their life and then have this pocket of denial around their sexuality because they are so shame-based and we don't talk about it and we're not allowed to talk about it as freely. We can speak about sex in a way that might be kind of titillating, but to really get into a heartfelt, soul-wrenching conversation about our sexuality is just not something that we do a lot of. And certainly when people are growing up, they're kind of encouraged not to talk about sex with their parents or their, adults. And what do they learn about? They learn about sexually transmitted diseases and birth control and babies. All of the important things about sexuality, like pleasure and consent and communication, are completely absent from sex education.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the people that I've seen who are very, very fine people and they have upstanding morals and a lot of commitment to doing good in the world and then have a complete disconnect with their sexuality where they could actually end up perpetrating and may have perpetrated sexual abuse or sexual harassment or something, you know, that might come very close to date rape. And you wonder how could somebody that enlightened or that aware do something like that? And, you know, I can't tell you that I have the answer to it, but I have an answer to it. And for me, it just seems that the sexual aspects of most people live off in a corner that has nothing to do with the rest of themselves. It's like the shame has isolated it into a little shame pocket. And when they do actually behave in a sexual way, it has no connection to the rest of their moral fiber.
That's fascinating. And that's a pretty good segue because we wanted to talk today about guilt and shame and how guilt and empathy can save us from shame and low self-esteem. Or as you put it, how to tell the difference between shame and guilt. And why is it so important? These are deep questions, Veronica, and I think it's important to have the discussion. So let's go to it further along.
Thank you, Diana. I think it's a crucial topic, especially today. We are living in an age where any of us have very many secrets anymore. So mm-hmm. I think we're being invited to kind of come out of the closet on a lot of different topics and be more open and transparent. Let's dive into that. It's a kind of a counterintuitive concept, this idea that guilt might be a good thing and shame is a bad thing. Mm-hmm. And I use those words, good and bad, loosely, obviously, but just to illustrate the point. So here's what shame is. Shame actually attacks your core. Shame is this sense that there is something wrong with you. And if you buy into that feeling, if you actually think there's something defective about you or something about you that makes you worse than other people or maybe something about you that's beyond repair or irredeemable, that attitude will actually cause you to engage in more destructive behaviors. Some of those behaviors might be self-destructive. They might be hurtful to other people. For instance, if I'm working with someone who has an anger management issue, that's one mm-hmm. of my specialties is anger management, and if they are feeling deeply ashamed of something that they did, some form of violence that they perpetrated, I'm not going to be able to help them stop being violent. I'm not going to be able to help them stop acting out in their anger because this creates a vicious cycle. The shame actually propels people right back into the destructive, abusive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what happens with some of the people who sexually harass. I mean, let's take somebody like Harvey Weinstein. I've mm-hmm. never met him, so I really should not comment on him, but I'm going to anyway because it seems like so many of his perpetrations have been verified and are really out there for all of us to see. And this seems like a man who's got a compulsion. He can't stop. I don't know, if he's got some kind of a sex addiction, but I do think that if he feels ashamed of what he did the first time and he never really addresses that, then he's going to be propelled into doing it again. And so the first thing you have to do when you behave in a way that's destructive to yourself and or other people is you've got to get rid of the shame. You cannot believe that there's something inherently bad or wrong about you, because it kind of dooms you to continue to perpetrate. Instead, what you want to do is connect with your empathy with yourself, for yourself, and your empathy for the people that you've harmed. And this is where guilt comes in. Guilt is actually a powerful motivator, and it feels very different than shame. Guilt is that nagging feeling that, oh, my God, I messed up. I don't want to do that. I don't like that. That feels nasty. I want to change that. How can I change that? I'll make that better. So that sensation needs to be firmly connected to empathy for other people, because if you're not actually putting yourself in their shoes and getting a sense of what their experience of your perpetration was, you risk tipping over into self-pity. Now, self-pity makes it all about you. The guy who comes up and says, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I just feel horrible. I feel horrible about what I did. That person's immersed in shame and self-pity, and they're not going to change. They're just looking for forgiveness. It's all about them. They're completely immersed in their own experience of shame. But the person who feels guilty and wants to actually make a solid amends and change their behavior, it's going to be more like, wow, you know, that was pretty careless of me. I don't like the way that came out at all. Matter of fact, I'd like the chance to do that again. I'd like to do that better. Can we start over? Or can I somehow or another compensate you? Or that must have felt really shitty for you. I'm so sorry that I caused that. What can I do to make it better? So see, your focus is on the other person.
People can learn from their mistakes only when they acknowledge that something went wrong. And for those who are a bit healthier, I think the emotions also motivate the person to make amends when feeling embarrassment, guilt, or shame. People that are healthier try indeed to repair what they have damaged by saving face or offering help to others. It's interesting because criminals who feel guilt are less likely to end up back in jail. And
isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
And parsing that out, because most people will say, I feel guilty and ashamed, and they kind of have a hard time of separating those two. So one is, I don't like what I did, and the other is, I don't like me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really, really crucial that you don't stop liking yourself, because if you do, you're not going to feel that you're redeemable. You're not going to feel that you're worth the trouble to learn a new, better, more positive response. And then you can't believe that other people could ever forgive you or love you. And so then, of course, why not just do it again or do something worse next time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So... Now, you say you like to help people to connect with their guilt in a positive way. Can you give some more examples of that? And how is it, because a lot of people listening would say, how is this even possible?
Yeah, and why would you want to do that to the poor person, though?
Yeah.
Well, so I really move in with my clients to establish a connection with their inner child, who I believe all of our inner children are so innocent and so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I'm coming from. I don't care what you've done, and I work with people who have done some pretty serious things. I love you. I love you, and I love your inner child, and I love the part of you that is absolutely just pure love. So how do I get you connected to that aspect of yourself, regardless of what you've done? How do I get you to see that part of yourself and to love yourself as much as I do? And that's really how I work with my clients, is moving them towards their inner child and reminding them that that's actually who they are. And all the other stuff, which usually starts with something horrible was done to them, which then takes them away from that innocence and puts them into a place of trying to defend and protect themselves. And eventually that defense and that protection turns into perpetration. and to get them to really experience empathy for themselves so that then they can have empathy for others. And as soon as you have empathy for yourself, you are going to have empathy for other people. And if you've harmed other people, your empathy for them is going to translate to guilt. And guilt is simply a motivating energy to make it right. And if you can't make it right with that particular individual or that particular situation, there's a way in which you can restore some karmic grace, if you will, by putting other good things into the world. And that's the most important thing to me, is that whoever we are and whatever we've done and whatever was done to us, that we stay connected to the fact that we are beautiful and we can do better and that we want to do better. And oftentimes we have to learn how to do better. So it's so important to get help from other people. I love support groups, 12-step groups, therapists. All of those resources are awesome to start learning new behaviors. And when you achieve success in that, then you start to have your faith restored in yourself. You start to enjoy your connection with yourself and other people. But it's not so much that I try to help my clients feel guilty as that I connect them to their empathy for themselves and the people that they've harmed. And guilt's just a natural byproduct of that, and then that usually leads to us formulating a plan for how they're going to make an amends. And once they've made that amends, they feel so good about themselves and so good about life. And really, the amends process, it doesn't even matter if the other person becomes somebody in your life or not. It really has nothing to do with that. It's about your journey with yourself and shifting your perspective and reclaiming your integrity, your sense of respect.
All of these things are so important. I really like that you focus on helping these people, that your clients, with their inner child, which is more innocent, and helping them connect back with themselves and realize what they've done. And you know, it's very hard for some people to access the ability to think about the perspective of another as distinct from feeling what another is feeling. It's the perspective, right? That is linked to benevolent actions, like a lot in life. Thinking about the feelings of others hinges on emotional regulation, and lots of folks don't have that. A person who can control his own emotions, especially negative ones like anger and anxiety, without denying them, will be able to tolerate others' upsets, and they're not as prompted to run from them, and they're more able to help. That's why I think that therapists and coaches who have a good degree of emotional regulation are the most effective and the most helpful. Lots of therapists, when they're in undergraduate school, will take abnormal psych, wondering, well, how come I'm so fucked up? You know, and I want to find out.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. And so I think it's really important. You've done work. I've done work. On personal work, so that you're a balanced person helping somebody who's not so balanced, and you have this emotional regulation. Don't you agree?
Well, certainly. But to get to that emotional regulation that you're talking about, I help my clients by learning some very simple basic anger management techniques like breathing and taking a time out. And paying attention to what's happening in their body, if their fists are clenching or their jaw is tightening or their breath is becoming shallow. And then, of course, we want to move into self-soothing, which is where you start to change your internal dialogue, because most people have got these voices in their head that were put there by the adults in their early life.
Yeah.
And they're very, very negative voices. So some of the worst crimes, the most violent perpetrations, really are motivated by shame. And you can read a whole bunch about that in James Gilligan's book, Violence. It came out in the 90s. It's an excellent resource, though. And he just documents how some of the worst criminals in prison killed somebody simply because they felt shamed. And a lot of it's happening in their head. It's not that the other person did anything to shame them. It's that maybe they looked at them the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So that what's going on inside of the violent person, of the angry person, is actually a lot of shaming, a lot of a sense that somehow or another I've got to restore my honor or my dignity by hurting this other person. Now, for some of us, that might be, you know, flaming on Facebook or flipping somebody off in traffic. There's this way in which people feel shamed and threatened, and so the way they respond is to do something abusive.
Mm-hmm.
But if we change the way we think and feel about ourselves, then the need for that goes away. And, you know, one of the things I always like to do, just to check where I am emotionally on any given day, is how do I feel about the people around me? If everybody around me has got some kind of problem and I feel critical of them, maybe I think they're poorly dressed or they don't talk right or they're fat or whatever judgments I may have, that's a reflection on how I'm feeling about myself that day. And I want to go in and I want to clean house and I want to look at, okay, so where is the low self-esteem and the shame for me right now today? How can I work with that and stop making it about the people out there? So
very,
much of this work,
very good points. And you mentioned self-soothing in the mix, and I think that's really important. I know with my clients, if I want to know how they calm themselves, him or her, or indeed whether they can, because the ability to self-soothe underlines more than moral capacity. It's a prerequisite for good decision-making in every domain of experience. The ability to self-soothe after an upset.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes. And, you know, there are people that can fake empathy. We have leaders that are doing that all the time.
Some of them better than others.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, true empathy, I think, does show up early in life, and it endures, and people can learn it if they have good outside help. So you want to ask, how motivated is someone to care when you are hurt, and how mindful is a person toward your goals? And empathy is, well, I think it's laudable by itself, but it has enormous social utility. It's a source of restraint against abuse and exploitation of others, and even of yourself, because you have to figure out yourself. And these leaders that are good at faking empathy, many of them are at heart ruthless, and they're just faking it.
Yep, sociopaths. Yeah, definitely. Looking for ways to manipulate us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Part of good character is to have goodness, and you can't have goodness without empathy, I think, or this ability to control your own emotions.
Even when you're talking about the dark triad, which would be Machiavellians, narcissism, and psychopaths, even with them, I want to practice empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And now, with one caveat, which is a friend of mine recently said, you know, an alligator is an alligator. You can have empathy for the alligator, but you don't want to get too close because it might kill you. So
Yeah, true enough.
If I have identified somebody who has the dark triad characteristics or one of them to such an extent that I think they're dangerous, like a dangerous animal, like an alligator, then I need to behave accordingly. I need to protect myself.
Protect
but
yourself.
That doesn't mean that I can't have empathy. And I'll give you, for instance, my father was mentally ill and very dangerous. But I loved him. And even though he had perpetrated against me and really gave me a very dark, troubled childhood, you know, once I reclaimed my dignity and empathy for myself and healed myself for, you know, 30 plus years of recovery, I didn't have any need to have a resentment against him. And as a matter of fact, I felt a tremendous amount of compassion for him because, you know, he wasn't born mentally ill, I don't think. I suppose it's possible, but he certainly had a progressive mental illness that got worse over time. And I think it was exacerbated by the abuse of his childhood.
Yes,
so I had lots of empathy for that, and at the same time, I kept a safe distance.
Yeah.
And
So, you're part of, you mentioned this, and then a big part of your approach to all of this shame and is how do you heal from the shame? And you did it with your father, but can you expand on that, the healing part?
Well, yes. You know, it took a lot of different forms. One of the first things I had to do was disassociate myself from the Christian cult that I was raised in. It was a doomsday cult. And it was a very shaming religion. I personally think a lot of religions are very shaming, but this one was exceptionally so.
Mm-hmm.
And so becoming familiar with other world religions, I actually took a couple terms of world religion in college just so I could break free of some of the dogma that I was raised in and get some sense of, there's other belief systems and other spiritual leaders and other books that people refer to. And so that kind of gave it less, the one that I was raised in had less power over me and my idea of what's real and what's not real. The other thing that really helped was sharing. So I was in a lot of 12-step support groups for abuse survivors, and I felt so seen and so loved and so embraced, and then I was able to fill that for them. They were filling that for me. It was just, it was a beautiful thing to talk, to expose the secrets, to let it out so that I'm not keeping all this stuff inside. So, kind of familiarizing yourself with history, too. Like when I think about sexual shame, there's been all kinds of relationships that people have had with sex over the millennia. If we go back far enough, you know, there were entire temples devoted to sexual union as part of one of the ways that we seek higher knowledge and connection to God.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, several thousand years later, we're living in a time where sex is somehow or another a way to give a high five to the devil, I guess. So The fact that those belief systems have changed over time is really helpful, too, if you're trying to navigate to your own relationship with yourself that's free of shame, especially sexual shame. I just think it's so important to know that whatever is culturally normative right now isn't necessarily the way it's always been, and it's not even the way it is all over the planet either. And there are other ways the human being can relate sexually. So therefore, the shaming becomes a social control, doesn't it? It becomes a way of trying to force people to conform to a particular standard. And knowing that it's actually a form of social control also really helped me to free myself of its bondage. To say, okay, so there's been lots of different ways to be humans on this planet, and not everybody agrees on what the best way is. I don't have to necessarily submit myself to this particular standard. And certainly, if I do find a way of life that works for me and works for me sexually, I don't want it to be based upon shame and fear, because the very definition of love is it's the opposite of fear, and shame is all about fear.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So support history, you know, history and support groups and sharing your secrets, at least with one other human being on this planet, is very, very freeing. And then giving yourself an opportunity to explore various different ways that you might want to be as a human being, particularly if it's sex, to try different ways of being sexual until you find what really resonates with you, and to enter a place of curiosity instead of contempt, a place of love instead of fear, a place of acceptance of yourself instead of shame.
So in some of the cults where the young women are forced to marry older men, they don't have that chance to explore, and their curiosity is stepped on. Was the cult that you were raised in, did it have some of those elements?
No, it did not, and yet it did. So let me explain. It's so interesting. I actually had an opportunity to speak to somebody who'd been raised in the Warren Jeff cult.
Yes, I guess I was thinking about that one from what I just said.
Well, it's interesting because I actually spoke with her quite a bit, and she said that of all the people she'd ever talked to, it was the only person who actually understood how it was for her to grow up. As a young woman. And I was like, oh, my God, so the cult I was raised in had a lot more similarities with Warren Jeff's cult than I would like to admit that it had.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they weren't raping the young women and marrying them off at an early age. However, because of the authoritarian, male-dominated culture of this particular cult that I was raised in, which was the Worldwide Church of God, it seems that it attracted a lot of pedophiles. And it's just, you know, if you make it so that you're kind of secretive, you don't want people to know where your church services are, you're anti-culture, you don't trust the government, you don't trust other people, that makes you kind of start keeping secrets. And then if you really think that because you're the husband, you're like Jesus Christ and you should have absolute authority over your wife and your kids, it can lead to abuse of that nature. And I saw a lot of it. And so in that sense, yes, there was some of that, but it wasn't officially sanctioned by the church.
So how large a cult was the one that you were raised in, and are you at liberty to say approximately what part? Was it in California somewhere?
Oh, no, it was a worldwide Church of God. It's all over the planet. Herbert W. Armstrong founded it. He had the Ambassador College.
Wow.
It was a big deal. They had the Plain Truth Magazine, the World Tomorrow broadcast, so they were all over television, radio, and there was a big lawsuit. Actually, one of the members had written a screenplay and tried to shop it, and it got rejected. But then very shortly after that, that same production company produced Indiana Jones' Temple of Doom.
Mm.
It was Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was the episode of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. So there was actually a lawsuit because they felt that storyline had been stolen from this church member. And I remember when I went to see Raiders of the Lost Ark, I thought, this storyline reminds me of the Bible stories I was raised with.
Interesting. I don't remember the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, or even if I saw it, but you put it all together.
I did, before I ever heard about the lawsuit, and then it turns out, yes, one of our church members actually probably did contribute some of that storyline, and that's why he was suing for money. But anyway, yeah, they were a big deal, and eventually the founder, when he was 80 years old, married a woman in her 30s who was divorcee, and this was a big scandal at the church. And I remember him speaking to about 10,000 of us up in Tacoma, Washington at one of the annual church conventions, and he pounded his fist down on the podium and said, "I am the right hand of God. You will not question me."
Oh. Well, didn't you have a reaction to that?
Well, I was 19. I was in college. I was already breaking every rule in the church, but I could not bring myself to speak badly about the founder because he was extolled very much like Jesus or God. And the day he did that, I thought, well, that's heresy. You can't do that. So that was the day he gave me my freedom to leave the cult. That was it. I was done.
Yes.
Yeah.
You came to your senses.
That much. I was so afraid that the fear and the shame is so oppressive that it can chain you no matter where you are. And so, yeah, that was kind of awakening for me when he said that. It was like, oh, no, you're not, and I'm out of here.
I think, Veronica, you were too much of an independent thinker. I think that a lot of people in the more fundamentalist religions are looking for answers, and the answers are often strictly from the Bible, and there's a lot of kind of black and white thinking. I'm making some stereotypical statements, but I think there's some truth in, well, there's always some truth in stereotypes, but don't you think that a lot of people really want the answers and they want to follow a cult kind of leader?
Well, absolutely. You're describing my mother to a T, because after the founder, after Herbert W. Armstrong died, the church splintered off into about 100 different groups, and some of them rejected Herbert W. Armstrong's doctrine, and some of them upheld it, and they went through this 10-year period of division and discord, and some of the former members released a video about how it was a cult, and my mother was just torn up inside. She was crying all the time, and she said to me, this is what she said to me. She goes, "It's like you don't know what to believe anymore."
Mm.
And I thought it was so sad, because I thought, yeah, because you need somebody to tell you what to believe. And that, to me, is just such a sad place to be.
How did you escape that? Because you started to be quite an independent, self-sufficient young woman from I don't know what age, but how did you escape that?
You know, some of us are just born a certain way, I guess. But I also think I was the family scapegoat.
Oh, well, yes, okay.
So, you know, that kind of sets you up to be independent and separate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was like, well, I'm not really part of this family anyway, so I get to think for myself.
Mm-hmm.
The three of them were much more, they conformed to each other's worldview. And I always was very, very independent. But I think there's this other thing that happened. Very early in my life, I had to be sent away to the hospital repeatedly because I had an infected kidney and nobody knew that I did. And I was at death's door for like a year. And in the process of not being home and being in the hospital instead, I think I also became very independent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your health was defective, and so what lessons did you take from that, being in the hospital and wanting to feel strong but not being able to be strong?
So that's an interesting thing, because my father shamed me around my health. He said, "You always were the sickly one."
Yes.
Now, the reason that I'm laughing, Diana, is because I'm way healthier than the rest of my family today.
Yeah.
You take care
of yourself, and you do the yoga, and you exercise, and you weightlift. Don't you do all of those things?
I do, and I also, I'm almost vegan. I'm not quite. I eat some fish, but I'm very close to being vegan. So, you know, the other thing that I want to say about this whole thing about shame, particularly if anybody is shaming you about your health or your body, I know from myself, being shamed around that actually motivated me to take even better care of myself and to excel. So sometimes we can take the thing that we've been shamed about and we can actually use it. I mean, you see this all the time in the Olympics, right? The guy or the gal who's got like one leg and they're running circles around the rest of us because they're just not going to let that disability hold them back.
Right.
And yeah, so it is an invitation from life. I think adversity can invite us to excel and actually do even better than we would have if we hadn't had that particular obstacle in our path. And I like to think of shame as the same thing. If somebody's going to shame me around something, I'm going to move in the opposite direction of empowering myself on that topic.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly the church that I was raised in, the family I was raised in, had a lot of sexual shame, and most of that was projection. You know, we had pedophiles on my mother's side of the family and my father's side of the family, so they're projecting their sexual shame onto me as an innocent child. But my reaction to it was really to allow myself to find my own empowerment around sexuality. So I just would like to make that as an invitation to your listeners to be looking for areas in your life where you might feel less than or ashamed of, and look for ways in which you can actually become more empowered around that and make it one of your strong points, one of the places where you really shine.
I think that's a very important lesson. In your case, and we talked about this in past shows in May of this year and even a bit last year, where you felt so empowered around your sexuality that you were able to work as a high-end escort. And you didn't, as far as I can tell, you didn't have guilt around that.
No, I didn't have guilt or shame around it.
Or shame, yes.
But the thing is that I was 29 years old when I started escorting. I already had a Bachelor of Science in Psychology. I had been an honor student. I'd been an English tutor. I had been a marketing representative for a radio station. I'd been an office manager for a computer company. I had an extensive background in corporate environs and in academe, and I felt really confident about myself and really good about myself. So when I stepped into escorting, it was not at a beginning level. I started at, you know, the high end and worked my way up to even higher end escorting. And so it was really a very glamorous lifestyle, and I wound up, you know, in the New York Times and CNN and Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, and because I wasn't ashamed and I was willing to speak openly about it, and I really went to bat for sex worker rights.
Well, and also you could carry on very intelligent conversations with your wealthy Johns.
That's clients, darling, clients.
Clients, sorry. I'm struggling for a word. I apologize.
That's okay.
A John is a much lower level.
But
must have been very appealing. Here you are, a beautiful...
I don't care if the man is a truck driver or a billionaire. They're all people deserving of a dignified nomenclature. So they're clients.
Yes, of course. Funny. So, to my point, so for a very successful businessman, he must have been totally enthralled that you could speak about business.
I thought so many times I was, you know, it's really interesting. One time I was profiled on some talk show, I don't even remember what it was, but I remember Greg Kinnear, the Academy Award winning actor, who was at the time just working on one of those entertainment shows, he said, "I think she's the most intelligent prostitute on TV." I really took that as a huge compliment. I like that. I've never forgotten that he said that.
Yeah, good. It was a compliment.
It really shows a lot about our stereotype, which is unfortunate. We have this stereotype that sex workers are somehow or another stupid, and so they get into this line of work because they don't know how to do anything else. And I'm here to tell you that if you're talking about street prostitution, that is oftentimes survival sex, and that's not because those people are stupid. It's because they're uneducated and don't have resources,
right.
And so therefore there's less things available to them. But that's like 10-20% of the prostitution in the United States. The other 80% is taking place online behind closed doors, and the vast majority of those people are college-educated women. So there's lots of intelligent and smart women out there who work in the sex industry. And fortunately, since I started being a voice for that, I've noticed in the last 20 years, we've got more and more smart sex workers speaking out and blogging. They're just, you know, they impressed the hell out of me. I'm really impressed mm-hmm. with them.
What motivated you to formally leave that work?
Mostly it was law enforcement.
Ah, okay.
so tired of looking over my shoulder.
Yeah.
And I had gotten arrested, and then they evicted me from the apartment it wasn't one I lived in. I just happened to work in it, but they did an eviction on that, which was not a big deal because I started flying around the U.S. after that. But it was that, and then I got audited, and I'd been paying my taxes the whole time, so that wasn't a big deal either. And, you know, but after a while, I was like, I'm so tired of being on this side of things. I want to have some breathing room, and that was, for me, the negative aspect of it, was just that we don't consider it to be an honorable profession in the United States yet. I certainly am hoping and praying for that day when we can honor and respect our sex workers, because I think they're wonderful people and they're doing a great service in the world. But
I agree with you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
It's not the case yet. And then there was this one other thing. When I was 8 years old, I wanted to be an author. And that dream stayed with me my entire life, and it's still something that's very near and dear to me. But at the age of 44, I told my husband, I said, I have to have my book published by the time I'm 45. And it was so funny because he says, well, do you have an agent? I go, no. Is there a publisher that's assigned with you? I go, no. He said, well, then how do you know you're going to get published? And I said, I don't know. I just know. It's going to get published when I'm 45, and I need to retire so that I can go write it. So I sold the house, and I moved to a cabin in the woods, and I wrote my book. And lo and behold, an agent popped up out of nowhere, and I got a book deal. And so my book was published when I was 45.
So we move toward what we visualize, the whole Buddhist idea. Good for you.
We do. And one other thing that I want to share with you about when I became a sex worker, I started learning how to access my intuitive feminine nature, which was not something I'd been connected to before.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were all kinds of things I just knew instinctively. And it was just really kind of a witchy, goddessy place to be. And I was just so grateful that that aspect of myself was birthed through sex work.
Yes, to see oneself as a sexual goddess with sexual powers for the good. You know, I love what my lover, my fiance, says. He says, worship your woman and the goddess will reward you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely sort of attitude. Yes, it's nice. It's nice to alternately be worshipped and then to feel free sexually and to be a generous lover and to be an intuitive lover and all of those things. But if you see yourself as a goddess, you're more likely, it seems to me, to be able to do those things. And again, to be balanced and to feel good about your own sexuality, that's sort of essential, isn't it?
When I was working as a high-end escort, I envisioned myself as a sacred prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I definitely had the diva-esque attitude that I was somebody very special.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, though, I had a very reverential attitude towards what I was providing and bringing to my clients, and therefore what I brought to them was an attitude of service and adoration.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Yes,
you brought
of course.
The idea so, of service and adoration.
Absolutely.
As a sacred prostitute.
Right, which means that, once again, I'm looking at the innocent inner child. I'm looking for
mm-hmm.
this beautiful core place where we are, all of us, only love. So my clients, who knows what they were actually doing in their lives. They may have been doing some despicable things that I would not have agreed with. But for the time that they were with me, it was a time to connect with their divine self and their higher self, and hopefully to evoke their better angels, to bring out the best in them. And, you know, I think a lot of high-end escorts actually kind of think of themselves as muses. It's like we're trying to evoke the beauty in our clients.
And so, consequently, the relationship can take on many healing properties.
It does.
Yeah.
It absolutely does, yeah. Yeah.
Because you had some clients who had some difficult sexual issues, and by being with somebody as enlightened as you and as knowledgeable and enlightened in terms of seeing yourself being of service and showing adoration, I imagine a lot of these men have never been with somebody like you with those sorts of attitudes. So it would be healing.
Well, you know, one of the great things about a professional sexual encounter is that you get to kind of suspend some of what happens in a mutual sexual encounter. Now, you can have divine interaction in either one. But it's just like if I go to speak to, you know, visit with one of my girlfriends and I share my problems with her, she's also going to share her problems with me. We have this give and take. And
mm-hmm.
that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. But if I go to talk to my therapist, I get their undivided attention and we're just focused on my stuff and the help that I need from them.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true when it comes to professional sexual services. The focus is so much on the client and evoking what is going to be the ideal situation for them. But it can be divine. It can be a very sacred spiritual experience, but it's in that container that you would expect a priest to create, right? So that you are getting all this love bestowed upon you.
Veronica, pretty soon I'm going to hear the music, which means the end of this program. I'm delighted, and I know our listeners will be delighted to hear that you're returning for a part two December the 12th. So
yes.
Maybe we can talk, well, you and I will talk off the air, but maybe we can talk more about sexual healing and oh, there's so many other areas of discussion that you and I can pursue because we have no trouble coming up with things to talk about.
I would love that, Diana. Would love it, love it, love it. Thank you,
Veronica, so much. You're always a great guest. Goodbye, everybody.
E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore.